this morning and the group this morning. A reflection came up about a poem I often share in this style of retreat. And there was some interest in the others in the group to receive the poem, hear the poem, and so I decided I'll start with that today. It's a kind of a, it's a Tibetan poem, a poem from the Tibetan teacher Lama Gendun Rinpoche. And for me, it speaks so strongly to the practice that we're doing here and evokes a lot of what we've been exploring. Almost as a, to me it reads like a guided meditation or kind of a set of practice reminders. And so that's how I'll offer it now. We'll start with a little bit of a sitting with this reflection from Lama Gendun Rinpoche dropped in to the sitting. And we'll sit for, I don't know, we'll sit for a few minutes following the poem too, and then shift into exploring some other reflections. I think first a couple of comments too about my own relationship to this teaching. I probably first heard it some 20 years ago on a retreat. I think James Baraz was the first person who said it to me, and I immediately asked him for a copy. But as I began practicing with Sayadaw Tejaniya and began understanding the workings of the mind and really appreciating just this witnessing stance, the stance that we're exploring experience from, just receiving, noticing the conditioned nature of experience. This poem kind of kept coming up for me, kept kind of arising for me. And so on one retreat, it was a 6-week retreat I was doing in Hawaii, I decided to memorize the poem. And I haven't retained it. I mean, I can't do it from memory right now. I could if I reminded myself a little bit, but I didn't bother to do that today, so I will have to read it. But there's something lovely about memorizing something that resonates so deeply for us, because it then has the opportunity to, like, what happened for me during that retreat was, the reason I wanted to memorize it was because little, like, snippets would come up in my meditation, and it was like that little snippet was just what I needed to be attending to in that moment. And then the mind kind of was grasping, and what was the next thing? And so I just decided to make sure that it was available. And having it available, it becomes a living experience. This particular teaching for me became very alive for that particular 6 weeks, arising, phrases coming in over and over again, deepening my understanding of them by having them arise with experience. And so you may or may not resonate with this poem the way I do, but if there are teachings that you find that do resonate, it can be useful to memorize them. Useful to, as the phrase goes, commit them to heart. Happiness cannot be found through great effort and willpower. but is already present in open relaxation and letting go. Don't strain yourself. There is nothing to do or undo. Whatever momentarily arises in the body-mind has no real importance at all, has little reality whatsoever. Why identify with and become attached to it, passing judgment upon it and ourselves? Far better to let the entire game happen on its own, springing up and falling back like waves, without changing or manipulating anything, and noticing how everything vanishes and reappears, magically, again and again, time without end. Only our searching for happiness prevents us from seeing it. It's like a vivid rainbow which you pursue without ever catching, or a dog chasing its own tail. Although peace and happiness do not exist as an actual thing or place, it's always available and accompanies you every instant. Don't believe in the reality of good and bad experiences. They're like today's ephemeral weather, like rainbows in the sky. Wanting to grasp the ungraspable, you exhaust yourself in vain. As soon as you open and relax this tight fist of grasping, infinite space is there, open, inviting, and comfortable. Make use of this spaciousness, this freedom and natural ease. Don't search any further, looking for the great awakened elephant who is already resting quietly at home in front of your own hearth. Nothing to do or undo. Nothing to force. Nothing to want, and nothing missing. Emaho. Amazing. Everything happens by itself. one sentence in particular that really resonates for me in this is the "nothing to do or undo." That "nothing to undo" piece speaks to me to the way in which the habit of mind is to figure out a way to let go of something that's catching us or sticking us, or, you know, doing the practice in order that something happen, often something shift or change. And that "nothing to undo," you know, seeing something arise in the mind, "oh, don't need to undo this." As if we could undo it, as if we could back up and, like, make it arise differently. So I'm particularly grateful for the this version of the translation. It's not, this poem was not originally given in English, and so this is a translation, and there are some different translations out there, some of which don't include that "undo" piece. And for me, that's been a really helpful recognition. All right, nothing to undo. This too, self-hatred's arising, nothing to undo. So I will post this. I'm not sure how easy it is to post the whole thing on the retreat announcements page. I can post a link to it on the retreat announcements page, but I'll post a PDF file with with this talk. You know, we can post documents on Audio Dharma, and so it will be sitting with the PDF file will be sitting with the talk that you can get to by using the retreat code. So some questions. Just exploring some of these questions. One brief announcement before the questions. There was apparently a little glitch or something in the Zoom meeting format where the automatic mute, when everybody is automatically muted upon entering the meeting, that apparently got undone, and we're not exactly sure how that happened. We've verified that the remainder of the meetings are set up so that they will mute, but we don't know how it ever got unmuted. And so just briefly check when you come in that you are muted, especially for the sittings. There was apparently last night some random noises coming from the houses, and that's fine. You know, we can practice with hearing, but it's also nice to mute that when we don't have to hear the sounds of other people doing their things in around the house. So the first question is a pretty straightforward one, kind of just a question about whether the teachings in the suttas are offered as instructions or descriptions, or perhaps both. And they are offered as both. And some of what is described, or what some of what those teachings are descriptions of experience, descriptions of the unfolding nature of experience, as we've been talking about, like dependent origination is more of a description of how suffering comes to be. And I don't think of us as saying, okay, dependent origination is a practice. Let's practice dependent origination. Dependent origination is the habitual unfolding of our minds that the Buddha could articulate. And then there are practices to use with dependent origination, like to observe how the links condition each other, to recognize the arising of the links, to recognize the arising of feeling and how it leads to craving. But it's not like we pick that up and say, okay, I'm going to practice dependent origination now. I'm going to practice feeling leading to craving. We get to just witness it. And so there are different teachings, different. Sometimes there are teachings that emphasize the nature of the unfolding of the experience, and others that emphasize how to observe the experience. So some are more instructional. But even in the instructional ones, for instance, in the Satipatthana Sutta, the descriptions, like for instance, in the section of feeling tone, it says something like the instructions or the Satipatthana Sutta, the words of the sutta say something like, when feeling a pleasant feeling, one understands, I feel a pleasant feeling. When feeling an unpleasant feeling, one understands, I feel an unpleasant feeling. In another section, in the section on mind states, it says when, and this is a paraphrase, when greed is arising, one understands greed is arising. And so it could be taken as this section of the sutta, the section on mindfulness of mind states, where it enumerates, notice greed, aversion, and delusion. Notice the absence of greed, aversion, and delusion, as well as some other mind states. It could be encouraged as an instruction to kind of orient to look at mind states, or it can be understood as simply recognizing when mind states, these mind states are arising, notice them. So the instructions in the Satipatthana Sutta, and many of the instructions actually, can be understood either as kind of more of a receptive form of practice, or as pick up feeling for a little while, pick up feeling tone for a little while and play with it. See if you can get to know it. See what happens as you observe it. So I think there's room for both interpretations of the meditation instructions of the Buddha in the suttas. So another question. Can you explain what you mean when you talk about little bursts of continuity of awareness? I think of continuity as extending over time or across different contexts or conditions. So I'm confused about what a little burst of continuity might be. Continuity, the power of continuous mindfulness comes when that some of the deep power of the seeing that can happen comes when the mindfulness is just moment after moment after moment after moment after moment. It's like a powerful stream of mindfulness and wisdom that are arising. At one point, on one three-month course, I was practicing and was describing, some of what I was noticing, and that I was kind of coming in and out of equanimity and reported this to Steve Armstrong, and he said, the commentaries say, and I can't remember exactly the number, but it was like commentaries say that like 90% of the mind moments have to be mindful in order for equanimity to be present. And I thought, oh, I'm not there. 90% of, just the percentage wise, I knew that I wasn't quite there. Certainly not for long stretches of time. And so, this notion of mind moments can be, sometimes it's useful, sometimes it's not useful, but in this context, I want to bring it in because I think it might help to explain what I mean by a burst of continuity. So, in the Abhidhamma, in the Buddhist psychology, which is a commentarial teaching, the teachings talk about there being like these vanishingly small moments of mindfulness. And each moment, there will either be mindfulness or not mindfulness. Each moment, there may be the arising of a of a defilement, of a reactive state, greed, aversion, and delusion might be arising, or maybe wisdom is arising. And these mind moments are said to be vanishingly small. You know, they are essentially, you know, arising and vanishing. One is arising and vanishing, even as it's arising, it's vanishing. And it's said that there's, you know, something like 17 trillion, I think is the number, 17 trillion mind moments in the blink of an eye. So there, that blink. 17 trillion mind moments. And so in that space of 17 trillion mind moments, there may be some moments of mindfulness and some moments of non-mindfulness and moments of reactivity arising and seeing it. And to me, this the vanishingly small nature of these mind moments explains to some extent why it feels like we can be completely, fully mindful of reactivity arising. Maybe, and I don't know if this mind moment theory is actually true or not. It's useful to kind of use in some kind of contexts and not necessarily in others. The Buddha didn't seem to emphasize this perspective. What he emphasized is that, yes, you can be aware of a hindrance while it's happening. You know, so he didn't necessarily talk about when that's happening. What's happening really is a really rapid alternation between the hindrance and the mindfulness. He didn't say it that way. He just described, yes, we can be aware when the hindrance is arising. Notice when the hindrance is arising. Notice when the hindrance is passing. When there's greed arising in the mind, one understands there's greed arising in the mind. He talked about it in very ordinary ways. And so, you know, the mind moment theory, we can sometimes use it in a way to, you know, bludgeon ourselves of like, well, if there's a, you know, a hindrance arising, it means there's not mindfulness there. But, you know, there's this interweaving, perhaps, or maybe it's more like what the Buddha described, that the experience of it is that we can be aware while reactivity is happening. But in any case, the using this mind moment kind of theory, the more perhaps mindfulness is arising in those moments, there's more continuity. So in the blink of an eye, there can be either kind of really powerful continuity or, well, a little bit weaker continuity. And so in the space of a few seconds, there can be a little bit stronger continuity or a little bit weaker continuity. You know, when the hindrances are strong and we're caught by the hindrances, maybe the mindfulness is a little weaker there. When the mind is able to see those hindrances and not be reactive to them, there's more continuity of mindfulness. And perhaps when the mind sees the arising of reactivity and it just vanishes upon being seen, that the continuity is stronger still. And so there's a kind of a way that we can think about the continuity happening in waves, maybe. Sometimes it'll be stronger, sometimes it'll be weaker, and sometimes it'll be stronger for a few seconds, and sometimes it'll be weaker. That the kind of the continuity of mindfulness may be a little weaker, and it may feel like there's a little bit less mindfulness. It's not quite as strong. Perhaps the momentum of the hindrance is stronger than the mindfulness, something like that. That's maybe what it feels like. And so what I mean by burst of continuity is a moment when that kind of the power of the clear seeing, the mindfulness and wisdom arises strongly, and maybe just for like 2 seconds that happens. And in that couple of seconds, the mind, it doesn't take long for the mind to actually penetrate when mindfulness and wisdom are really strong. That penetration of understanding can happen in a split second. Now, that's not always what happens. sometimes the practice unfolds in a much more gradual way. I often bring in the, maybe I did. Did I bring in the rotting rope? This time, no. Okay. sometimes it's more the gradual wearing away that happens just over time, of seeing the same thing, the same kind of pattern, not the same pattern, but the same kind of activity happening over and over again, and meeting it and understanding something a little different about it each time, and it just weakens over time. The image the Buddha used, one of the images, he had a number of images to kind of describe the gradual nature of this path, the gradual nature of the freeing of the mind, actually. And one of those images was that of a ship that has been out at sea for a long time, getting soaked, soaked with the wind and the water and the sun and the sand, and maybe there's a shipwreck, and maybe it's pulled up on dry land for the dry season, or maybe the parts of the ship get strewn on the beach if there's a shipwreck, and there's like the planks and the rigging, the rope, like strewn about the beach. And the wind and the sun and the sand and the waves kind of gradually wash over those parts of the ship. And if you think about how that works, if you were to visit that beach every day, look at the rope, it doesn't look like there's much change each day in the rope. But the work is happening. The work is happening. The wearing away is happening. And I love the rope image because it's like, the rope is something that ties things together. We use the term fetter sometimes. We're tied, we're knotted to something. And those fibers that make that fetter in this image get gradually weakened through the washing of the sun, the sand, the wind, sometimes in dry, just sitting in the dry for a while, baked by the sun, sometimes getting washed by the waves. And the Buddha talks about these as part of the practice, the wise mindfulness, the wisdom, the energy, as being that action of the sun and the sand and the wind, and that will wear away, gradually, slowly wear away our greed, aversion, and delusion. And so much of the practice seems to unfold in that way, where we don't see each moment what is being released. Sometimes Gill says, no moment of mindfulness is ever wasted. And this is what I think he's pointing to. It's like, yeah, every washing of the rope with the sun and the sand and the wind, every one of those has some contribution to the weakening of that fiber. Every moment of mindfulness contributes to the mind moving in the direction of letting go and greed, aversion, and delusion. And so sometimes it happens in that gradual way, but there are times. And so I don't want to diminish at all that. That seems to be actually most of the way my practice has unfolded, in that gradual way. There are a few experiences that do happen when the mindfulness, the continuity, that burst of continuity comes and it sees into a pattern, sees into the conditionality of that pattern in a split second, and the pattern just it's like the rope just falls apart in a split second. And it's seen that it's fallen apart. And that can be very gratifying, and it can be very seductive. We think that's the way insights are supposed to happen. And some of them do happen that way. you know, with those bursts of continuity. And I want to encourage that possibility of noticing those moments when mindfulness arises. And for me, they seem to happen. They happen in connection often with when suffering is happening. It's like, you know, the mindfulness kind of hovers for a lot of the day. But as soon as there's a kind of the beginning of suffering starting to come, some kind of reactivity being born, it's like the mindfulness, like that's like a support for the continuity of a little burst of mindfulness in that moment to see what's going on there, and maybe to let it go, or maybe to just be with it. So, you know, these bursts of continuity, you know, it's sometimes they can be extremely powerful. I often tell the story of, like, my very first really clear insight that happened, you know, while I was cutting an apple in the kitchen. And I'd been practicing noticing anger for a couple of months, you know, noticing anger arises, yeah, it's unpleasant, it hurts. Not really understanding, actually, you know, and so this is maybe a place or a way we can see these different waves, these different ways of the gradual and the sudden kind of coming together. So I had had months of recognizing anger, just kind of in the more ordinary ways of like, wow, that's anger, that hurts, that I don't feel very good, okay, yep, I know I'm angry, you know, just at that level. And in, like, retrospect, seeing, you know, what's going on there is the mind is starting to understand anger equals suffering. You know, that's what was happening during that time. The mind was getting an education. I saw many things like, wow, I thought this anger was making, you know, making the other person miserable, but what it's doing is making me miserable. You know, that was a shock. How could I not have seen that? You know, it's because the mind is doing something else when that anger is coming up. It's focused on the other person and what this anger is going to do to them, which is what was happening in my mind. So I didn't see that it was creating suffering here until starting to actually be aware of it. And so that was a kind of a gradual learning that was going on in that time. Nothing that I really understood or could articulate. But then there was this moment of cutting the apple in the kitchen. And in that moment, you know, it's like, I wasn't particularly trying to be mindful, you know, maybe there was a kind of a mindfulness hovering, but, you know, I wasn't working very hard at all. I was cutting my apple. I was making my meal. And in that moment, you know, it's like there was this arising of thought in the mind about the person that I was angry with, and the burst of mindfulness began with that thought. The mind saw that thought and saw in that the kind of the intention, the movement, the wanting to jump on that thought and think more thoughts about that person so that I would get angry. So that was seen in a split second. That suffering, like the you know, and again in retrospect, the kind of attunement to this is what it's like to be aware while the mind is angry, was like the mind began to notice earlier and earlier in the process of anger getting constructed. And, you know, it's like it was noticing in that moment. It's like the burst of mindfulness arose in dependence on the mind heading towards suffering and saw it's heading towards suffering. So that little moment of mindfulness, and this whole thing that I'm describing with cutting the apple took about a second. Saw that thought, saw the intention to get on that thought and think more thoughts, saw the direction that was leading to anger, understood in that moment. And this is nothing that I was trying to do. This was revealed by this burst of mindfulness in this second, seeing these things arise in succession. Seeing the mind wanting to get angry and understanding, that way lies suffering. I don't think so. And the mind letting it go. All of that happened in about a second. And that's where, you know, that's what I'm thinking of when I use that phrase, burst of mindfulness, because burst of continuity. Because it took quite a bit of continuity of mindfulness to see that rapid unfolding. Now that access to that kind of seeing the mind conditioning itself moment to moment, like that takes some concentration and continuity of mindfulness. But I hadn't been sitting down and practicing concentration and trying to concentrate the mind. That arose partly because of the conditions of having been cultivating mindfulness around that particular state, around noticing anger. And so there was that little gift of that burst of continuity. And it freed the mind in that moment. It freed the mind from that anger. The mind saw in that moment the non-arising of anger. It saw the intention towards the anger, understood it was not yet angry, but headed there, and saw the letting go. Saw that anger did not arise very directly in that moment. Now that was a very, like, one of those mind-blowing kind of insights, you know, and it changed my life. That moment changed my life, I would say. And so, but it would never have happened had there not been those, like, you know, that willingness to, like, you know, yep, there's anger again, okay. Wow, that hurts, okay. You know, just that willingness to be with this in a kind of a more ordinary or less concentrated way, just a, you know. So these different kinds of understandings, the gradual and the sudden, you know, there's a phrase that Joseph also often brings, I think it's from Chanul. Sudden realization, gradual cultivation. And I think that's the way it's framed. Sudden realization, gradual cultivation. For me, it was turned around. It was gradual cultivation, sudden realization in that case. So they support each other. Now, sometimes we get those sudden realizations, and then we have to realize and recognize that one didn't, like, cut that, you know, and it certainly didn't cut anger forever for me, for that person, for that pattern. Anger kept coming up, but there was something that I understood in that, like, oh yeah, it's possible to not be caught by that anger. And yes, I understand how this is valuable. I'm going to keep doing this. And so there was gradual cultivation that followed from that sudden realization, that sudden understanding. So there is a continuity of mindfulness that does extend over time, and it's useful to cultivate that, as I was cultivating with the, you know, the kind of curiosity about the anger over that longer stretch of time. But what I mean by those bursts are these, like, sudden arisings of, like, the mind that can, like, just, it's like the knife cutting through. And if we're not available in those moments, you know, those little bursts of continuity might arise, and we might, like, instead just be interested in, oh, there's an apple in front of me or something, you know, rather than kind of, what is this revealing? So there's a kind of a way that we can begin to appreciate the moment, particularly when mindfulness returns. That moment has its own momentum. There is a little bit of a burst of continuity when mindfulness returns. And what is it revealing? So often we jump in that moment and judge ourselves for not having been mindful. And in that habitual reaction, it's like it undercuts the power of that arising mindfulness. And so, you know, for me, just remembering the, just noticing, like the orientation is, mindfulness is returned, not, oh, I was lost. And we're really looking at there, you know, the coming and going of mindfulness as a mental formation. You know, mindfulness is a mental formation. Wow, I'm doing a different riff here, so that's okay. Mindfulness is a mental formation, and it arises and passes, it arises and ceases. And instead of, you know, orient, and essentially what's happening when we see the wandering mind is like like around the edges of the mind wandering, we can be curious about what's happening there is that mindfulness has fallen away. And so what we're seeing there is that we can kind of just be curious about the coming and going in mindfulness rather than orienting around, you know, the mind being lost. You know, with the wandering mind being what we think of as primary, it's like, oh, mindfulness is back. Here it is. And that those moments I've found, at least in my own experience, those moments when mindfulness return can be very revelatory if we are curious about that mindfulness has returned. And just that curiosity for me, just kind of like, at some point it was like, I got really curious in that moment. Can I notice when mindfulness comes back? And, you know, that just curiosity like took away the judgment about the fact that it had wandered, because it didn't matter how many times the mind wandered. Every time it wandered was another opportunity to notice that re-arising of mindfulness and what it was like for that magic to come back, that magic, you know, moment of mindfulness to come back. So that was really helpful for me, I think, and supports that kind of recognizing these bursts. It's just that it doesn't matter if the mind wanders. It's like, can you notice when it comes back? What's that like? What is it knowing as it comes back? What is it taking birth into? What is that mindfulness arising into? You know, we think of mindfulness arising and then we come back to something else. But it's already arising aware of something. Often it's arising with the thought, or in this case it was arising with the thought, actually, in that story of the apple cutting. It was arising with the thought of the person I was angry with and recognizing almost like the danger sign there. Like, yeah, this way lies suffering if you jump on this thought. So that burst of mindfulness arose in that thought. And being aware of that allowed the mindfulness to see something that had not seen before. So another couple of questions that kind of connected in my mind, at least they connected, they might not obviously connect on the surface. And it feels a little related to what I was just talking about in a way, like allowing the mindfulness to arrive in what it's already experiencing and to step back from the being the one who has to be in charge of what gets known. That kind of allows the mind to see things that it wouldn't expect to see or doesn't know it could see. You know, that kind of mindfulness that can allow an opening to something that we've never seen before. So there was a kind of a question to kind of explore that terrain a little bit more. And then another question about, I talk about this, and I don't always talk about it, but I'll talk about it a little bit right now. Occasionally I talk about a couple of retreats where it became possible. Like what was happening was I started noticing that I was mindful in sleep and actually saw at certain points that the mindfulness could follow, it could track the falling asleep, the moment when it shifted from awake to asleep, and then mindful into a lucid dream. And so somebody asked to, you know, talk a little bit about that. How did that happen, or, you know, what might support that possibility of mindfulness and sleep? And what I would say there was I wasn't trying to do it. You know, that's kind of, that state of falling asleep is like one of the epitomes of the kind of thing that you can't try to be aware of, because the activity of trying to be aware of it is going to keep the mind awake. So it really has to be completely receptive. The way it happened for me was because this was in a stretch of time, and I've referred to this in a couple of the groups. There was a stretch of time for me, a long stretch of time, where energy was very low. It felt like I could barely get up energy to be mindful, and began to explore it and play with it, and realize that, you know, there was a gift there in a way, because the low energy state, when I tried to bring mindfulness, when I tried to be mindful, when I tried to engage in even the subtlest kind of investigation, it was like this searing tension and pain in the mind. So it was low energy, and it felt like I should do something to try to be mindful, but anything I did created so much suffering that I had to explore things from the side of, the suffering of trying to do anything was so painful. I had to just, say, okay, I guess I just get to look at this from the side of low energy. And essentially, it was that kind of practice. It's like, well, awareness is here. Wow, I didn't do that. Awareness arose. There's low energy, yep, and there's seeing, and there's hearing, and yep, that's happening. And then it would vanish, it would go away. I couldn't make it continue. I just really had to be with it when it came back. And so that was what I had to practice with. And the kind of the encouragement for myself was, you know, this is the condition right now. This is there is this way. There is practice happening. And over time, even in that low energy state, the continuity became stronger, because there was the kind of the recognition of the mindfulness returning spontaneously, and the wisdom developing there. And so there was a kind of a strengthening of the mindfulness. But it was all an exploration from a complete, step-back, non-doing perspective. And that was the gift, in a way, of that couple of years of having such low energy and feeling like any movement to doing was very painful. Was that I had to just step back and be completely the naturalist. And sometimes it's like I fell asleep in the forest and didn't get to see anything. And and I wake up and okay, what do I get to see? And then I fall asleep again. And it's like I just had to take what I got. And so the practice around that low energy, and just the willingness to be with that, seemed to be the condition that allowed the mind to. It's like sometimes in those low energy states. Here, I'll describe this. Sometimes in those low energy states, there can be a feeling of a dropping and a letting go, or a kind of a removing or a distancing, or the mind that just kind of drops and falls or something. And the mindfulness began to kind of be able to be in that. So the energy would go even lower, and or there would be a letting go and a kind of a shift of that state, which felt like a kind of a dropping and a spreading, and the mindfulness could track that. Again, not because I was trying to do it, but because of that kind of just that curiosity of being willing to be with whatever was coming as it was possible to be with it. And so that feeling of the dropping experience, that's a similar feeling to the falling asleep feeling. And so I kind of feel like there was a connection there, that exploration around the real low energy states and the willingness to ride them, not try to do anything, not try to raise the energy, not try to shift anything when it was happening. Just what can the mindfulness see? When does it disappear? That kind of exploration. That seemed to be the foundation for the capacity for the mind. Just noticing. You know, actually, noticed it a couple times. I noticed this kind of experience that I'd get this like zap. You know, I get this zap in the meditation. It was a little bit unpleasant, like an electrical charge or something. And a little while later, I began noticing that I was dreaming, and I'd wake up, and I'd realize, wow, I'd actually fallen asleep. And it took a while, but at some point, I began wondering whether there was a connection between that zap and the sleeping process. And there was one experience where I could see, I saw this like this kind of softening, releasing, and then felt that zap. And another thing I began noticing before this was that after I'd fallen asleep, sometimes I could be mindful in that place, that sometimes mindfulness would arise in the sleep. I would have these wild dreams, and they were often, you know, doing things in meditation centers. You know, I'd find myself cleaning up after cats in the meditation center. And that would often wake me up. It's like, wait, there's no cats in the meditation center. And then I would end up back in the dream and meditating. And so it's like, so when the mind wandered in the dream, it would wander into normal dreamlike stuff. And when it woke up in the dream, it didn't come out of sleep. It was meditating in the dream. And I began noticing there's some differences there, like my legs would float. You know, I would be in exactly the same posture that I was in my I was doing lying meditation. That was another way that it happened, is I was doing almost exclusively lying meditation. So there wasn't any kind of a dropping of the body when I fell asleep. The body was supported. So that probably also helped. So I was doing the lying meditation, and what I noticed that when I was in the dream state, the legs could float, you know, that I could just check, you know. It's like that was kind of a little test. It's like, oh, am I dreaming, or is this like, am I really meditating in my room here? It's like, well, let's check. Are my legs floating? And if I was dreaming, my legs would float. And so this time I watched the kind of the transition, saw that zap, noticed it, and then immediately thought to check, well, let's see, are my legs floating? And they were. And so that moment, I think that's actually the moment. For me, at least, that's the experience. There's a slightly unpleasant transition from wake to sleep. And the mind could follow it into that lucid dream, where essentially the dream was that I was meditating in my place. That it was like everything was exactly the same as what had happened before I was asleep, only my legs could float. And then the mind would wander into some kind of dream or other, because I wasn't trying to do this. I wasn't trying to do any of this. And so I guess that's what I would say about, you know, what helps with sustaining awareness in sleepiness and continuing into sleeping. letting go of trying. Willingness to let the mind go into sleep without judging yourself. Waking up, noticing the state that it's in when you wake up, sometimes connected to that kind of fuzzy, foggy, sleepy state. So it really, for me, a lot of the gift of the sleepiness, the low energy, the working with that, was the gift of complete receptivity and not judging that this is what's happening. And honoring, wow, there was so much that was learned in those couple of years around that low energy. So much was learned. So much respecting the uncontrollable, not-self nature of experience. So, yeah, it's time to stop. I hope that was useful. That was a pretty extended description of something that, from my own practice, and sometimes I'm not sure how useful that is. Mostly I will offer it with the kind of the, hopefully with the understanding or the reflection that it's the way this unfolded was through respecting what was arising, not by trying to make something happen. And so in talking about that kind of thing, that's more what I want to convey. It's not that you can make that happen, but that the way in is through this, just this. Honoring what's arising. It all has a possibility to show us the nature of experience, without exception. Even the rising and passing of mindfulness can show us that. So we should stop. Thank you for your practice, for your love of the Dharma, which I see in all of those meetings with you. It's so wonderful to be spending this time with you. Thank you.